Hello, everybody. This is Salil Tripathi from the Institute for Human Rights and Business. I'm talking with Jennifer Zirk, who is a researcher and scholar on trade and human rights issues. And she has recently prepared a report for Chatham House on the human rights impact assessments of trade agreements. This podcast is in two parts. The first part discusses who should carry out human rights impact assessments. Should it be states or corporations? And when during the trade agreement negotiations, how and when they can be carried out. In the second part, we will be discussing whether any human rights impact assessment have influenced specific policy changes, who should pay for them, and what expertise is required. I thought what we might want to do is, if you can tell us at the beginning, what were the key findings of your research on trade and human rights and the impact assessments?
Yes, of course, and thank you so much, Celia. It's really nice to talk to you about this. This was a piece of work that I did over the course of 2018 with Chatham House about the emerging practice of human rights impact assessment of trade agreements. The first point to make is that the practice of human rights impact assessment of trade agreements, at least as far as states is concerned, is not actually that widespread, and that's despite increasing calls by UN agencies, by national human rights institutions and civil society organisations as well to carry out these kinds of exercises. So that's interesting. The most advanced and systematic practice in this area is really to be found in the EU in the form of the sustainability impact assessment process that they engage in prior to signing of trade agreements by the EU. But elsewhere, practice is pretty patchy. And the second point to note, which I think is probably related to the first, is that a human rights impact assessment of trade agreements is incredibly difficult to do. You can't just take methodologies that have been developed, for example, for the corporate context or for specific policy interventions and expect them to work in relation to an ex-ante assessment of a trade agreement, because there is a world of difference in terms of scale and complexity between assessing the human rights impacts of a corporate investment or a particular project and assessing the impact of a future trade agreement on an entire economy years and decades into the future. So there's an even more fundamental point to mention, though, and that is the difficulty in determining causal relationships in this context. That is to say that there are real challenges in linking back certain impacts, both mm-hmm. positive and negative, right, you know, back to the trade agreement specifically. And there's two main reasons for that. The first is the complexity and interconnectedness of economies. And that, you know, that's the obvious point. Mm-hmm. Secondly, there's the point that trade agreements are actually made up of obligations and exceptions, flexibilities. Mm-hmm. So a lot depends on how you actually implement the trade agreement in practice, and all the mitigation measures that a state may or may not be able to take, the economic and political pressures that may be in play. And none of these things are terribly easy to predict, you know, in a kind of snapshot exercise in advance. On the other hand, advocates of human rights impact assessments of trade agreements argue really strongly that even if these kinds of things are difficult, and even if in the main they struggle to provide, you know, really compelling analyses of the relationships between trade agreements and you know, enjoyment of human rights subsequently, they're still really valuable exercises to do in terms of, well, firstly, highlighting certain risks, mm-hmm. especially risks to vulnerable people who may get overlooked by the more kind of conventional economic analysis of a trade agreement. But the second point that's made in favour of them is that they also provide a really needed platform for stakeholder engagement on trade policy. They're a chance for people to express their concerns about how a new trading agreement may affect them, their livelihoods, families and communities at quite a detailed level. But you know, the final point I'd make is that for those arguments in favour of human rights impact assessment to really work, they really require, first of all, stakeholder engagement to be done well. And the second point is that the risks identified in the assessment process have to be able to be followed up in some way, in some kind of systematic and coherent way. And so what the research suggests is that there's still a lot of work to be done to make sure that those two elements in particular actually happened.
There's a lot to unpack here, so let me go step by step. The first would be a rather obvious question and not an easy one. Who should be doing the assessment? Should it be the state or a group of states? Should it be an individual company, a group of companies? Should they do it in combination? Should the civil society be part of it? I mean, I know there's no one-size-fits-all solution, but do you have a preferred approach?
Well, the research that we were doing was concerned primarily with human rights impact assessment of trade agreements by states and state-based institutions. However, because of the paucity of state practice outside the EU, meant that we also looked at other kinds of assessments, including some that were carried out by academics and academic institutions as part of research, and some that were carried out by national human rights institutions or by civil society organisations or as part of studies that UN agencies have mandated. So anyone can do them, but the question we're particularly interested in is, to what extent are states doing this in response to the specific call to states by UN agencies to engage in these kinds of activities? I mean, basically, what the UN agencies are doing is to be able to fully understand the human rights implications of the trade agreements that you're signing up to, you need to do this kind of assessment at state level. But then, the difficulty with that, as I mentioned, is that these exercises are really, really complex, costly. It's unlikely that there's going to be a massive take-up by states until it's clear that these kinds of exercises can actually deliver what's claimed for them. And that they have a real value as a policy-making tool, that they can actually deliver recommendations that are capable of being taken up by trade negotiators and policymakers and implemented. So, I mean, you can see, Salil, there's a chicken and egg problem.
Right.
There's not take-up because there isn't the practice to draw from, and, there isn't the practice to draw from because there isn't the state to take up. And you actually made a really interesting point there about the extent to which states and companies can work collaboratively on these processes. And I do actually think it's worth thinking about how engagement with companies, and especially those leaders in corporate social responsibility and business and human rights, how engagement with them can help provide assessors with a more complete picture of the kinds of changes that a new trade agreement might bring about, for example, in relation to global supply chains.
Mm-hmm.
And what risk mitigation strategies might be useful. And that's one area where I think there is scope for, and there probably needs to be a bit more link up between business and human rights agenda and the trade policy more generally. And it is something I think the European Commission might be interested in doing more of in the future. We need to think a bit more about how to integrate companies into that kind of process. There's another issue about whether the states that are involved in the negotiations, so the two trading partners, the extent to which they should be collaborating on these processes, maybe doing more in the way of joint assessments. But at the moment, in the EU at least, we have this slightly odd situation where the Commission assessments seem to focus a bit more on what's going on in the other country, rather than what's actually happening in the EU. And I do understand why that happens, but it does throw up some tricky legal and political issues. So yes, there's scope for anyone with an interest to do these kinds of assessments, but if they're going to have policy impact, it's like these need to be done at state level, really, by state-based institutions. But as I said, I think there is more scope for collaborating with companies as part of the stakeholder engagement piece, and also perhaps more that could be done collaboratively between the states concerned. But as we might come to, there are some tricky elements.
The other tricky element is, of course, the whole globalization aspect of it, that when you decide to impose sanctions on a country or, not trade with a specific country, it has adverse impacts on that country. And you might want to do it on good human rights grounds, such as, eliminating child labor or ensuring that there's no forced labor, or a country that doesn't have union rules, for example. And this also comes up in the context of investment, that an assessment of which is entirely domestic might show that an auto plant that closes down in Britain, like in Sunderland, is terrible for Britain, but it may be excellent for Thailand or Vietnam, where the plant goes and many more workers can be recruited. So the impacts, could be adverse in one part of the world, but positive elsewhere. And even the positive could be mixed, in the sense that, yes, jobs in bad conditions are created, but they're still better than there being no jobs, which might have been the situation before. So I know that one assessment cannot fine-tune it. And obviously, someone has to take an executive decision based on what the assessment throws up. But do you see a role for more global assessment so that it doesn't look at it only from the perspective of the receiving or the importing country?
Yeah, it's a really, really interesting question. And it kind of goes back to what I was saying earlier about possibilities for more joint assessment.
Yes.
I mean, the first point to make is, I think, the point that you already made, that human rights impact assessments themselves don't solve this problem. But what it does mean is that the state concerned doesn't go into an agreement blind, you know, that they understand what the impacts are likely to be, and then they're in a better position to be able to take steps to mitigate the worst of those impacts for people. But in terms of cross-border impacts, it's very difficult for one state to do that well. I mean, basically, there are several different views you can take about what the scope of these kinds of assessments could be. I mean, if you take the view that the state should be focusing on impacts within its own jurisdiction, then in the example that you gave, the UK would be focusing on, you know, what's going on in Swindon or Sunderland, what's going on within UK territory and what the impacts are likely to be. And then the other party would do something similar in their own jurisdiction in relation to their own impacts. But the problem is then you don't have much link up between the two. You can't see the interrelationships between those two effects very clearly. And there may not be sort of consistency in the way those assessments are done. If you take the view that states need to be looking at these things more broadly, in a more sort of cross-border kind of way, then you really run up against the challenge here. There's a real challenge here in this particular context, in that these kinds of assessments are taking place against the background of often very difficult and technical trade negotiations in which each party is trying to secure the best deal for itself. So that in that environment, there's likely to be limits to the kinds of information that state parties, you know, can and want to share. Alternatively, what you could do is kind of adopt the approach that the European Commission adopts, and that's to focus your attention for the assessment on where the human rights impacts are likely to be most acute, which often in practice, in the way that the EU approaches this, causes attention to be focused on what is going on in the poorer, you know, in the less developed of the two states. You know, as you can imagine, there are, you know, political and legal challenges that come up there. So, I mean, the short answer to your question is that if you want to do that well, you know, understand those sort of cross-border or more global, you know, implications well, then the answer would be through sort of a more joint human rights impact assessment approach, or perhaps making more of extraterritorial impact assessments to help kind of show up these impacts. But then there are always going to be political sensitivities and possible legal problems, particularly if one state starts to try investigating possible human rights problems in another.